From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Today in New York, before the UN Security Council, Secretary of State Colin Powell rolled out a full dress presentation of U.S. evidence that Iraq has and continues to conspire to conceal banned weapons from UN inspectors. His intent? To win over skeptical nations to the U.S. position that force may be required imminently to bring Iraq to heel. Tonight on Point, the tapes, the photos, their impact, and who's on board for war. We begin tonight with diplomatic response from the Security Council. Julia Preston is chief UN correspondent for the New York Times. She joins us now live from New York. Julia, what did Security Council member states make of Colin Powell's big presentation?
Well, I think they were quite impressed by the comprehensive nature of the presentation. It really was a lot of information. Many of the council nations did not depart from the comments that they had prepared beforehand, so there was a kind of caution about responding right after the meeting.
We could almost hear that in the remarks, that they were canned, they had been prepared for any eventuality.
Yes, that's right. But I think there were many signs that the effect of Mr. Powell's statement was to really sharply increase the pressure on Baghdad to come up with a dramatic change of heart in the next few days.
What were those signs, Julia? The representatives from France and elsewhere were very poker-faced during his delivery, as you might expect. What tea leaves are you reading here?
Well, you know, the weapons inspectors are going to Baghdad this weekend, and then they will report back to the council on February 14th. Mm-hmm. And there was quite a clear sense that that report, if there is not a word from the inspectors that Iraq has really changed its stripes on this, is going to be a very decisive moment.
Does that mean if Saddam does not fold his hand in the next 10 days, are we headed toward a coalition of the willing then, or toward a UN-sanctioned war?
Well, it was clear today France came forward with a proposal to what they call strengthen the inspections, and they were backed by Germany very strongly on this. The idea is that you would double the number of inspectors mm-hmm. and post inspectors at some permanent locations around Iraq. You know, the French are definitely looking for some way to continue the inspections process and slow down the movement from Washington towards war.
But Colin Powell was not fishing for that today. It didn't seem at all that he's interested in that. So does that mean they're still on a collision course?
I think it's maybe a little soon to talk about collisions. You know, this report from Secretary Powell is quite fresh today. It mm-hmm. was a lot of information. Many nations said that they wanted to take this back to their capitals. They were anxious to see that Secretary Powell gave this information to the weapons inspectors. They want the inspectors to go to Baghdad and, if possible, verify some of this information mm-hmm. or put it to Saddam Hussein. And so, you know, I think we're going to have a very intense period of diplomacy in the coming days, and it may be a little soon to call exactly how this is going to go.
Does a veto by France, Russia, China, one of them, still seem possible?
I don't think we are looking at a veto. I think that the United States options at this point, based on what happens in the coming days, mm-hmm. are either, if they have some sense of new support, they might come back to the Security Council for a second resolution. If not, if it continues to be that France and Germany are really strongly opposed and Russia's not coming around, then I think the United States will just go its own way.
So they just won't come back. There won't be an explicit rejection of the U.S. effort, but neither would there be, in that case, an additional U.N. resolution. We hear that Tony Blair desperately wants and needs that at for his home U.K. constituency.
Well, interestingly, Foreign Secretary
Jack Straw, very strong today.
He did not mention that.
Mm-hmm.
He was very strong today. He said that the inspections were a charade, or that Iraq mm-hmm. had made them a charade.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that basically if Iraq doesn't come around before February 14th, then the game is up.
Julia, finally, what was your sense when they looked at Colin Powell's presentation today? Were there particular elements that member state representatives found persuasive, or was it simply the volume, the groaning board of evidence?
Well, I think that nations are somewhat reluctant to speak in a public forum about something like the audio tapes, but I think it was quite impressive to a number of people. Whether or not it will really sway an opinion in a place like France or in Germany, mm-hmm. that's hard to say. But it was quite an impressive presentation, I think, for many council members.
Julia, a big day. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Julia Preston is chief UN correspondent for the New York Times. She spoke with us from New York.
Clearly, Saddam Hussein and his regime will stop at nothing until something stops him.
Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein has made an active and systematic effort to hide his country's weapons of mass destruction from UN weapons inspectors, and he has given safe harbor to al-Qaeda terrorists, Colin Powell told the UN Security Council today. Tonight, we examine the evidence. We test Colin Powell's case and look ahead. Were you persuaded today? Did the evidence make the case for more inspections or for the U.S. Marines? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from McLean, Virginia, is Vincent Canestraro, former chief of operations and analysis at the CIA Counterterrorism Center and an expert on Middle East terrorism. Good evening and welcome, Vincent Canestraro.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Also with us tonight from the UK, Glenn Rangwala, a close observer of Iraqi weapons programs and lecturer in Middle East politics at Cambridge University. Good evening and thank you for staying up so late, Glenn Rangwala.
Good evening.
It's great to have you on board. We're going to get into the details of the evidence presented today, but I'd like to just come to each of you first with a top-line question, a simple question. Vincent Canestraro, I'll come to you first, if I may. Did Colin Powell make a persuasive case before the UN Security Council today, in your mind?
He made a persuasive case when the presentation is looked at in its totality. What clearly emerges is a pattern of concealment by the Saddam Hussein regime and an attempt to deceive the inspections process itself. I don't think there was any one individual piece of evidence that was conclusive in and of itself, but the pattern of the intercepts, the satellite photography, the human source reports, all of that added up to, I think, a compelling case.
So we'll look at the details, but top line, you say a compelling case, a case sufficient, as Colin Powell suggests, to do the necessary to stop Saddam Hussein, i.e. war?
Well, I don't think that he was pitching this presentation on the necessity for war. I think he was trying to pitch it to public opinion and why we are so concerned about it.
He talked about the need for imminent action, not in months, but perhaps just in weeks. You heard the quote we had here just at the top of this segment, him saying he won't stop until he is stopped.
Yes, I think that he made a case that Saddam Hussein is thumbing his nose at the Security Council resolution. Mm-hmm. I don't think he made a compelling case for military action against Saddam imminently.
We'll talk more about that. But Glenn Rangwala, let me just turn to you. Again, top level, you are deeply versed, as deep as anyone I know, in what's going on in Iraq. Was this, from your vantage, top line, a persuasive case that Saddam and Iraq are flouting 1441?
In a word, yes, in that Powell's presentation clearly showed that Iraq was not in full compliance with the terms of 1441. So very simple examples, it hasn't permitted U-2 surveillance planes piloted mm-hmm. by U.S. pilots mm-hmm. to overfly Iraq, and that is a formal breach of 1441. Mm-hmm. However, on the more substantive case about whether Iraq's possession and development of non-conventional weapons it poses a threat to international peace and security, the actual purpose of why we have inspections inside Iraq, then Powell was not convincing. He didn't show that there was a substantive program inside Iraq at present for developing non-conventional weapons, for weaponizing those agents.
With all the photographs, with all the voice intercepts, with all that, you say not persuasive?
Not persuasive in portraying an active Iraqi program for the development and use of non-conventional weapons, either against its own population or against the outside world.
Glenn Rangwala, we'll go through some of those, but I guess if I could, let me ask you, at that detailed level, where he was trying to give evidence that suggested exactly that, that there was and remains a weapons of mass destruction program intent and action in Iraq, among the particular pieces of evidence presented today, let me ask you what you found most persuasive. What did you find least persuasive?
The most persuasive aspect of it was about Iraqi attempts to obstruct inspectors. Now, that could be put down to the fact that Iraq actually has a program which is just trying to stop inspectors finding.
So the voice intercepts, for example, when they say, you know, get rid of the stuff, get the modified vehicle out of there, delete this word from your transmission. Was that, is that what you mean?
Some of them were, some of them weren't. Some of them could be interpretable through for other reasons. So, for example, that point where he's saying get rid of the word nerve agent,
yes,
get rid of the expression. Now, we're not told by Powell what the context of that discussion was. It could have been them debating the terminology to use in a document. And if that was the case, a document to be presented to Unmovic, for example, then that would not necessarily be a suspicious activity in its own right. And because Powell didn't mention the context, I think it casts some doubt upon what exactly was being discussed there.
And least persuasive in your mind among the many elements laid out today?
Least persuasive for me were some of the claims about the biological agents that Iraq has developed. So, for example, Powell brought back the old discussion of smallpox, and I think that claim has been thoroughly discredited, that Iraq has got a smallpox stock within Iraq, and also the nuclear side. I think Powell's discussion of Iraq's development of nuclear weapons, I think, was off the ball.
The aluminum tubes, lots of discussion about that today.
Exactly, yes. The aluminium tubes and the magnet production facility that Powell claimed was for centrifuges, but the weapons inspectors in the International Atomic Energy Agency have said are for other purposes.
Vince Canestraro, let me turn to you with the same question. Most persuasive evidence, least persuasive evidence today?
I think the most persuasive were the overhead photography of a chemical site and the corroboration of that site by a human source, because it brought together technical intelligence and human intelligence on the same event and reinforced each other. And I thought that was compelling. Mm-hmm. Certainly the audio tapes and the conversation in which nerve agent is mentioned, I think, was graphic and riveting. I think you certainly could take each individual piece of evidence presented in the speech and find an alternate interpretation. But I think when you put them all together, it's very difficult to escape the conclusion that Saddam Hussein has an active program of deceiving the inspectors and concealing a weapons program.
Did any single piece of the evidence there fall on your ear with a clunk, a thud, anything that just sounded...
Or I think when he went to the question of Saddam Hussein's sponsorship of terrorism and the linkages with al-Qaeda, I think he made a very circumstantial case there. I don't think there is any doubt, at least in my mind, on the linkages between Zarqawi, who is an al-Qaeda member, and with the Al-Ansar group up in northeastern Iraq, and between Zarqawi and a number of the cells in Europe that were arrested, particularly the one in London that had been handling ricin in an apartment. And I think, although Powell didn't spell that out in the speech, I think there is substantive evidence linking Zarqawi to the ricin and to the cell. But that doesn't get you directly to Saddam Hussein. It's a circumstantial case in that Zarqawi was in Baghdad, received medical treatment there, and then when the Jordanians, who have a warrant for his arrest, asked the Iraqi authorities to render him, the Iraqis claimed they didn't know he was in Iraq and they couldn't find him. That was certainly an indication that there may have been some collusion, but I don't think the case was made with the same kind of evidence that the weapons program itself, the chemical and the biological. I don't think that Powell specifically said that Saddam had smallpox. I think he used the phrase he may have.
And Glenn Rangwala, we just have 20 seconds before the break, but when the Secretary of State held up the tiny vial of anthrax, described what that did to Washington and painted the picture of a much larger destruction, is that reasonable? Is that a real threat?
There's two points really about that. One is that Secretary Powell was talking about dry anthrax, Now, as far as we know, as far as the weapons inspectors themselves know, Iraq never managed to produce dry anthrax. They produced wet anthrax, mm-hmm. which is a very different form. It experimented with drying techniques from 1989 to 1990.
Glenn Ringwala, forgive me. If you can hold that second thought, we'll come right back to it. We have to take a short break. We're talking about Colin Powell's UN Show and Tell on Iraq, its persuasiveness and world response. Were you persuaded? Did Colin Powell make the case for war? For war now, we're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Colin Powell's presentation to the UN Security Council today. Here's the Secretary of State telling the UN that now is the time to take action on Iraq.
Given Saddam Hussein's history of aggression, given what we know of his grandiose plans, given what we know of his terrorist associations, and given his determination to exact revenge on those who oppose him, should we take the risk that he will not someday use these weapons at a time and a place and in a manner of his choosing, at a time when the world is in a much weaker position to respond? The United States will not and cannot run that risk to the American people. Leaving Saddam Hussein in possession of weapons of mass destruction for a few more months or years is not an option, not in a post-September 11th world.
There it is, Secretary of State Colin Powell in the Security Council today. What do you think? Did the evidence make the case for more inspections or for the U.S. Marines? Did you find the evidence credible, compelling, believable? And if this didn't persuade the U.N., should the U.S. go it alone? Is it time for the coalition of the willing? Or is war simply wrong without the U.N. stamp of approval? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from McLean, Virginia, by Vince Canestraro, former chief of operations and analysis at the CIA Counterterrorism Center, and from Cambridge, England, Glenn Ringwala, a lecturer in Middle East politics at Cambridge University. Glenn Ringwala, I had to interrupt you before the break, but you were saying, A, Iraq doesn't have dry anthrax, and B...
Firstly, I'll just go over that first claim in slightly more detail.
Yes.
In Iraq in the late 1980s, it was producing a wet form of anthrax, a slurry form of anthrax, which wasn't easy to disseminate, and secondly, wasn't easy to store. So,
how would you disseminate wet anthrax?
You would have to engage with a spraying process.
I see.
Through an aerial sprayer mm-hmm. or other form of sprayer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that form is much more difficult to absorb into the body. And secondly, it doesn't last so long, which is my second point. So mm-hmm. any anthrax that Iraq had in the early 1990s would no longer be operational. It could no longer be weaponized.
So does that mean that the vial that the secretary held up today was irrelevant? Was that a piece of evidence or eyewash, in your view?
In its literal form, it's a piece of eyewash. There is the claim there that Iraq's precursor chemicals, its growth media, that it could have used to produce anthrax could have been retained and could still be developed. So in the yeast extract that Iraq imported before 1991 could still be turned into anthrax, and that is a serious claim and a serious argument. That argument is rather hodged by Secretary Powell. He didn't actually explain the detail there, and in a literal form, his claim was itself not an accurate one.
Mm. Vince Canestraro, you say you feel the impact of those aerial photos and the human source verification backing up Colin Powell's depiction of what's going on there. I guess as a layperson, I look at the photos. They're grainy. They're not as self-evident as what Adlai Stevenson put up on the board years ago. Can we feel confident that this is the real deal and not a milk depot shot from 30,000 feet?
I don't think it was a milk depot, and I don't think it was a fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
The question really is a photo interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And to a layperson, I agree. It isn't indicative of anything to a layperson. It's just a bunch of trucks and buildings on the ground.
But you have a more seasoned eye, and you?
Well, you need really a photo interpreter, someone who has spent his or her entire career working mm-hmm. on this kind of thing. How do you recognize, for example, a decontamination truck? I mean, it looks like any other kind of truck. But if you've had experience at looking at chemical processing plants in Iran or North Korea or another country for a long time, then you instantly recognize what you see when you see that same kind of vehicle on the ground in Iraq. In other words, it takes an experienced photo interpreter. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think as a piece of theater, it's probably less impressive to the layperson than it is to the intelligence professional.
But when you see the little yellow boxes and the arrows identifying this and that and that and that, you, as a former intelligence man, are prepared to believe?
I am. I'm certainly much more receptive to that because I have seen the process before and I've been involved in gathering intelligence on the ground that was later subjected to surveillance photography from satellites and correlated. So I know what the process is like. I'm certainly much more receptive to it. I'm certainly no photo interpreter myself. Mm-hmm. But I can see where a layperson is not going to be greatly impressed by that kind of photography.
Glenn Rangwala, when you saw the aerial photos, were you prepared to buy them as described by the secretary?
You see, what I was struck by when listening to Secretary Powell was that he made some very strong claims. He made the claim, for example, that Qusay, Saddam Hussein's son, ordered the removal of prohibited weapons from Saddam's palaces. Mm-hmm. Now, if he'd come out with a photograph of that, or if he'd come out with a photograph of his claim that bomb materials were being moved from weapons of mass destruction facilities, if he'd come out with those sort of photographs, then they would have been much more graphic. He didn't come out with photographs of those events. He came out with a photograph of a slightly peripheral facility, Al-Taji ammunition facility, where he was claiming that four of these 16 bunkers were used for chemicals. They were chemical bunkers, and that therefore they needed a decontamination truck next to them. Now, my question, the first question that I thought of when I saw that part of the presentation was, why did he focus on that particular incident?
And what conclusion do you come to, or what surmise?
Well, my impression then is that there isn't adequate evidence for those other claims that he made, the much more explicit claims that he made, without providing any substantive evidence for them. And the fact that he hasn't provided substantive evidence for those claims indicates to me that there isn't clear evidence for those claims that he was making.
You spent time debunking earlier U.S. claims. When nations sit back and go through today's presentation with a fine-tooth comb, presumably they will, how do you think this is going to stand up? A week from now, will it still be pushing the wave toward war, or might it dissipate?
I think this is clearly the most detailed presentation we've had from a member of the U.S. administration. And so really, on this presentation, I think the whole case for war will stand or fall. I should make it clear that I think the real discussion going on today was not whether or not Iraq has non-conventional weapons. That isn't really what today was about. It was about whether the inspections process is viable. And so what we haven't talked about, but you mentioned in your question, was whether or not inspectors would be able to find these sorts of things. If they do exist inside Iraq, would inspectors be able to track them?
And your sense?
My sense is that Powell was making the argument that inspectors would not be able to find them. The French position, as was related at the start of the program, was that inspectors, if they are beefed up, if their numbers are doubled, if they are able to stay at permanently at particular sites, would be able to find these facilities if they exist.
Do you agree or not?
I think inspectors have a very valuable role inside Iraq, firstly in actually finding these things, but more importantly in dissuading the Iraqi government from actually beginning a more comprehensive program to develop its weapons.
Vince Canestraro, can you imagine sticking with the inspectors here? Will they get the job done? Colin Powell, in the bulk of his evidence, seemed clearly, as Glenn Rangwala says, to be suggesting there is no way inspectors are going to ferret out all this stuff.
I think that's the conclusion that the Powell was trying to put forth, is that the inspection process cannot find these weapons. Of course, the French response is, well, if we can't do it with what we have, we need a much more robust inspections regime, more muscular. And there is a certain merit in that. The problem for the Bush administration is that an enhanced inspection regime with a great many more inspectors on the ground is likely to be a drawn-out process.
Yes.
And it seems that the Bush administration is determined to go to war, regardless of whether or not a favorable Security Council mandate is received. So they apparently are trying to prepare the ground for some action that's imminent rather than something that would be postponed for several months.
That piece is very clear. Laura's calling from Gay Mills, Wisconsin. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I personally think that I don't really know whether this is fabricated or real, and I leave it to you fellows to debate that. But I need to speak as a mother here for a minute,
All right.
If you can bear with me.
Absolutely.
Because Well, from my view, it could easily be fabricated. I don't know.
But it could be too real.
It could be real. And I guess what I want to say is, if it is real, then Colin Powell certainly has persuaded me that someone needs to stop Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
But I think even more strongly, what he's persuaded me is that I don't want to see any mother's sons go into what he described.
So how do you do it? And if we sit back and wait, his suggestion is it'll come to us.
I don't know how you do it. All I know is there's got to be another way. There's probably a bunch of other ways.
Inspectors.
You know, maybe other people like the United States disarming some. I mean, why do we have the right to have all these weapons of mass destruction? We introduced them. You know, who's used them?
On the other hand, who else has the power? Do you know people in the military, Laura? Do you know folks who will be directly?
Yeah, I was just about to get to that because that's why I'm kind of whipped up. You know, I have a 20-year-old son, so I'm whipped up because it's very easy to imagine him. And when I see mothers who do have sons who are over there or on their way over there, and I see them spend the day crying today, I say, there's got to be another way. Are any of these men who are talking all about war like this, are any of them sending their sons, or are they going over there?
Laura, that is always the ultimate question. We thank you for raising it. Vince Canestraro, how do you respond? Laura reminds us that there is not a whiff of joking about this.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing I would like to say, I don't think there's a chance in the world that this presentation was fabricated. I think part of the process in producing the intelligence was a very laborious back and forth among the intelligence professionals about what could be released. And I think that goes to the question of why other information more sensitive on other parts of the WMD program were not released, I think, is because of the source sensitivity. So there was an argument about that. That was probably the best public case that could be made.
Vince, can I ask you something just there because you've come out of the CIA?
Sure.
You know, Colin Powell is a man who has tons of respect nationally and globally.
Yeah.
And you've been in the CIA. You know the culture there. I think Americans have learned to be skeptical. Just absolute, you know, po-faced believers in whatever's handed out. So can you really? I mean, I don't want to cast doubt. I don't want to say it's not the truth. I want to believe it. Yet the stakes are so high.
Well,
is there no vein within that intelligence world that would say, you know, we could? This photo looks pretty good. It may not quite prove this, but we could put it up there.
No, because this process was managed by Colin Powell himself, and so it really goes to the question of the integrity of Secretary Powell, not to the CIA or the DIA, the Pentagon, or the president's office. It goes to Colin Powell. It was his presentation. He was the one that chaired the meeting and the discussions. He's the one that rejected some of the more extreme statements that the Pentagon, the vice president's office, wanted to include in his presentation. And so it goes to the question, is Colin Powell a trustworthy person? I personally think he is. I worked for him. But, you know, and I think most Americans believe that as well.
So then to Laura,
believe that of other people in the administration. I grant that. There's no question about it.
To Laura's ultimate question, is there, even at this late hour, not another way, a way other than American boys going in to fight to who knows what will happen. And I guess what that means is it could inspections work now, or is it just too late?
Well, I personally believe that Saddam is contained, that whatever programs he has of weapons of mass destruction are under scrutiny, and that he can't do anything with them, and they can't exploit them, and that he is not a present danger to the West, and certainly not to the United States.
So you would not push the war button?
Absolutely not. I would not, because I really oppose old men sending young boys off to die. I really do. And Laura's question about, you know, are any of these people involved in the decision-making process, do they have their own sons involved? And the answer is probably not. So I think that that brings it home. There's no question in my mind that we are going to lose a lot of people. How many, I don't know. But there are going to be thousands of casualties, probably most of them Iraqis, but a lot of those will be innocent people who die as a result of that. And is that necessary now? I think most people will grant that, look, Saddam is an evil person, and he's deceptive, and he's a liar, and he probably wants to have all these weapons of mass destruction so he can intimidate his neighbors and enjoy some power. But is he a current danger, and is he contained right now? And if so, why do we have to go to war now? I happen to also think that the Bush administration has decided to go to war regardless, and I would think that war is probably very, very imminent, despite or never mind what the Security Council votes or doesn't vote.
Vincent Canestraro, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Absolutely.
Vincent Canestraro is former chief of operations and analysis at the CIA Counterterrorism Center. He led the CIA's investigation of the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Patrick Claussen. He's deputy director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Good evening and welcome, Patrick Claussen.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. You've heard some of the back and forth just now among our guests tonight and callers. What's your view, Patrick? Having seen Colin Powell's presentation today, is it time for more inspections? Is it time for war?
Well, the only reason that the inspections can proceed now is because there are tens and tens of thousands of troops that are pouring into the region. Saddam only allows the inspectors because he fears for the consequences if he doesn't.
So can we maintain that equipoise, keep enough troops to keep the inspectors effective and not hit the war button, or is there, as Powell pretty much suggested today, no other way than to go in and root this stuff out with an army?
It's going to be very difficult to maintain that pose of those tens of thousands of troops when what we have is all of the many European countries, criticizing us already for sending troops over there, and there's a lot of discontent in the United States about keeping the troops there. So it doesn't look like we can keep up this containment. Saddam may be contained today, but he's not going to be contained for very long. That we can't keep up this pose for the long term. We don't have the possibility of containing Saddam for decades the way that we contained the Soviets, because we don't have the Europeans with us in insisting that we've got to keep this guy contained over the long term.
And therefore, what do we draw from that? Does that mean it's time to go?
Is that really containment is not an option over the long term. It only works when you have troops around Saddam, and unfortunately we can't keep that up for the long term because we lack the support internationally to do that. We lack the support in the UN to do that.
But does that mean, in your view, that war is now necessary? Is that what you're saying?
Well, you have two choices. Either you can have war, or you have to face the fact that eventually containment will disappear, and then you have to ask what's Saddam going to do when there's no longer the inspectors there. All this stuff that Colin Powell was showing today, maybe he's not Saddam's not making weapons of mass destruction today, but boy, I would think that someone is doing all that effort to hide that stuff today. If he had a chance without the inspectors, he'd be making these weapons tomorrow.
That sounds like a vote for war. Glenn Rangwala, what's your view? You saw the case. Could we take the French line? Can we double up the inspectors and keep it going? Or as Patrick Claussen said, you can't keep all those troops, that gun to Saddam's head forever, and without it, the inspections won't work either. We'll be back in the swamp.
Yes, I think Patrick's reading of the European position is not quite my own reading. My impression is that from Europe, there is a strong support for an ongoing monitoring and verification process within Iraq. So to keep inspectors there in the long term, to keep facilities inside the country that will be able to monitor Iraq's primary sites that could produce chemical and biological and nuclear weapons. So I think from the European side, at least, there is a strong emphasis on keeping up a presence inside Iraq.
But in a way that wouldn't fall back into the kind of ultimately not very effective 90s inspection regime?
Well, you see, that was the other point from Patrick's remarks that I found myself in disagreement with. Patrick said that it's the troops that are surrounding Iraq's borders at the moment that are... it's only because of that inspections have been allowed inside Iraq. And for the present, that might be accurate. But during the 90s, when Iraq sensed it had an incentive to comply with inspectors in terms of the lifting of economic sanctions on Iraq, there was extensive compliance at certain periods of that time. So it's all about... It's all got to be phrased in terms of providing incentives to the Iraqi government, and that can either be a survival, which is the current incentive for the Iraqi government in complying, or it can be in terms of economic measures, and that's what worked during the 90s, parts of the 1990s.
But now a new trigger point comes near. Glenn Rangwala, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking about Colin Powell's UN show and tell on Iraq, its persuasiveness and world response. Were you persuaded by particular evidence or by its sheer volume or neither? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Secretary of State Colin Powell didn't just present his case for war with Iraq today. He also laid out a challenge to the UN Security Council.
Iraq has now placed itself in danger of the serious consequences called for in UN Resolution 1441. And this body places itself in danger of irrelevance if it allows Iraq to continue to defy its will without responding effectively and immediately. The issue before us is not how much time we are willing to give the inspectors to be frustrated by Iraqi obstruction. But how much longer are we willing to put up with Iraq's noncompliance before we, as a council, we as the United Nations say, enough, enough?
We are talking tonight about Colin Powell's UN show-and-tell today on Iraq, its persuasiveness and world response. Did Colin Powell leave you feeling in imminent danger? Or ready, like the French, the Russians, the Chinese, for more inspections? Did you feel he made the Iraq-Al-Qaeda link? Are we getting the whole story here, the right options? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight are Glenn Rangwala, joining us from Cambridge, England. He's a lecturer in Middle East politics at Cambridge University. And from Washington, Patrick Clausen, deputy director of the traditionally pro-Israel Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Terry's calling. Welcome, Terry. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
Thank you. I'm a veteran of Desert Storm, and back in 1988 and 89, I was in Germany and various parts of Europe, destroying the GLICKM, former GLICKM ground launch cruise missiles with wrenches, saws, and other tools.
These are East German missiles that were being taken apart, Terry?
Our missiles that were targeted for Eastern Europe.
Okay, I got it.
I was in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very much a gentleman's agreement and part of the SALT treaties, you know, destroy missiles.
Right.
There were Soviet and all sorts of inspectors that were witnessing the destruction of all these weapons as part of the agreement. And what we have found in Iraq is shells, aluminum tubes, and other methods of delivering all sorts of chemicals and mm-hmm. other mass weapons of destruction, as the term is.
So does it look like a counterpart to your experience? Can we go in there as gentlemen and piece by piece take it apart or not?
I don't believe so, because it's a game of cat and mouse. If we all remember well that the Scud missiles were hidden, a game of cat and mouse. Where are they tonight? Where are they going to launch? And we couldn't find them all during the Gulf War with all our troops there, and we're not going to be able to find all of his missiles and other destructive elements now.
In
as
Iraq
well
to...
as the other, mm. I'm sorry, the other thing that comes to mind was just post 9/11, a lot of the terrorists and terrorist suspects that were picked up. A lot of them were trying to get flying lessons, and some of them were getting crop dusting licenses right in the middle when they were picked up.
Yeah, we remember well, and Colin Powell laid out today, or at least by inference, a lot of material that we wouldn't want to have in those hands. Terry, I think we've got your point. Thanks for your call. Glenn Rangwala, here it is again, this sense that there's simply not enough receptivity on the part of Iraqis to make it possible to persuasively, convincingly, finally disarm this country, no matter how much time we have.
Yes, I think it's largely accurate that we will always be banging our head against a brick wall to some extent with the Iraqi government, and it will always be a game for inspectors of cat and mouse. My own impression is that it's better to play cat and mouse with the Iraqi government than to play kill and be killed, which is the other alternative. I think if we do keep inspectors there, they will be able to eliminate a large proportion of Iraq's weapons, but they will never be able to verify the complete destruction of Iraq's arsenal of non-conventional weapons. Mm.
Patrick Clausen, what about a cat and mouse or kill and be killed? What's the preference at this point?
Glenn is ignoring the lesson of the 1990s, which is that we can't keep the inspectors there. So at the moment, what we find in Europe, as he said, is a lot of support for keeping inspectors there. But just as in the 1990s, that support will probably evaporate. Because after all, it was France who insisted on the abolition of the previous inspection agency, and that's why it was abolished in 1998, because the French lost their support, stopped supporting it, and insisted it be abolished. And I think that if we went down the inspections route again, that what we would find is in a few years, once again, the French would come up with a new reason why they would say that this inspection agency, too, has to be abolished. And the Europeans tell us they're all in favor of having inspections, as Glenn said, but none of the Europeans are prepared to take the actions that would be necessary to get the inspections going. So I'm afraid that the answer is that if we don't go taking actions now to disarm Saddam, that indeed it's going to be a game of kill or be killed, and it's us who are going to be the ones who are going to be facing these weapons of mass destruction from the Iraqis.
It sounds like opposite views there that we're just not going to get around. Charles calling from Kingston, New Hampshire. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Good evening.
Good evening.
Idea that Saddam cannot be contained without inspectors on the ground 24/7 is ridiculous. We've had Saddam contained in a box since the Gulf War ended. We've had him contained for 10 and a half years. And I think this relates somewhat to the issue of the aerial photographs that were portrayed today showing the supposed chemical weapon sites.
What's the link, Charles?
I think it speaks to the possibility that things that are on the ground there may, in fact, not be reliably chemical weapons factories or depots or production sites or whatever.
So you weren't ready to believe the labels necessarily.
We've been dropping bombs on Iraq, weekly since 1991, surgical strikes, and would that stuff still be there?
Well, I don't think those targets have necessarily been our targets while we've policed the no-fly zones. But we've got your larger point, Charles. Let me put it to Patrick Klaus. And Patrick, here it is again. The sense, well, we've had him in a box. But did Colin Powell make the case today that we haven't had Saddam Hussein in a box this last decade?
I think he's also suggesting that after September 11th, we have to reevaluate the risks we face. Mm-hmm. Before September 11th, we thought we had bin Laden in a box. We thought we knew exactly what bin Laden was up to, and we thought we had a complete understanding of bin Laden's operations. And we turned out we were completely and utterly wrong. And we thought that we'd had bin Laden in a box for many years, and he was harmless, and we didn't have to worry about him.
But bin Laden was not a nation state. He didn't have boundaries. He didn't have a capital.
All the more things that possibilities for hiding things. We don't really know what Iraq has got. And what's so dangerous about Iraq is that it seems so determined to hang on to these kind of weapon systems. If, in fact, Iraq's not doing anything particularly dangerous, then why isn't it opening up and cooperating the way that South Africa did when it decided to disarm? If, in fact, Iraq's intentions are benign, then it should do what the South Africans or a decade later the Ukrainians did when they decided to give up their weapons of mass destruction and let the inspectors go anywhere and talk to anyone. The fact that Saddam's not doing that makes us suspicious that something's going on here.
Yeah,
it could be something really pretty terrible.
That's pretty clearly not the dynamic. Victor's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Victor. You're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to make the issue about the Iraqi scientists.
Yes.
Why is a code of silence being, imposed upon them as far as a threat? I mean, if anyone should have knowledge about these weapons of mass destruction to them, why are they given a gag order and, as a penalty for anti-patriotism and spying?
Mm-hmm.
Another reason I say we should send the military in because the containment policy can only work for so long, but you still have a festering cancer of Saddam Hussein's regime. What he's going to do is we may contain him for the next 20 years, but guess what he's going to do? He's going to export, these weapons of mass destruction terrorist groups. I mean,
so you're buying the link. You're buying the link between Baghdad and Al Qaeda, or ultimately some terrorist group.
And guess what? It's going to end up at our front door again, not a back door, our front door, just like September 11th. And guess what? Europe is going to suffer as well. So I don't know why Europe is delaying unless they got some personal interest in them. But those are something to consider.
Victor, thank you for your call. Glenn Rungwala, there you hear someone who listens to Colin Powell and says, yes, he's right on. And first of all, is this issue of scientists. We heard from the very beginning that the free and clear interrogation of these scientists would be critical to what's really going on. Colin Powell says today it's absolutely not happening, even that they're being under group house arrest in unknown locations. What did you make of what he had to say about Iraqi scientists today?
Yes, you see, this is one aspect of Powell's speech today, which really has been unsubstantiated. Very little evidence has been provided to show that Iraq is treating its scientists in this way, that it has provided some sort of threat towards them if they speak to inspectors in private or if they leave the country with the inspectors to be interviewed outside.
But they have not met much in private, if at all, as far as I know.
No, they haven't. Not one single inspector has chosen to be interviewed in private.
Doesn't that indicate something that they may be afraid that they will be accused later of having given away the game?
I'm not sure that necessarily follows. I think at the moment we are still in a situation of very high tension, and most Iraqi scientists are just unsure of how to stand on this. They're unsure about what option to take. Mm-hmm. As I think this process becomes normalized as we go into a routine inspections regime where inspectors aren't being followed around 24 hours a day by camera crews, mm-hmm. I think we'll see the situation where scientists are willing to be interviewed in private, as we saw from in the mid-1990s up to 1998.
And what about the terror link that Colin Powell made today? He went into that in some depth, attempting to make the case, which there's been an awful lot of debate over and not much satisfactory evidence to date, that there's a substantial Al-Qaeda-Baghdad link.
Yes, you see, I really don't understand why people think Iraq has got a reason to hit at the West. You can understand it with Al-Qaeda. You can understand it with Osama bin Laden, who have, a virulent hatred.
We did defeat him in the Gulf War. We did kill an awful lot of Iraqi soldiers. There was an attempt on the life of President Bush Sr. after his time in office.
That last one, I don't think, is necessarily true. There's a suspicion still about that incident in 1993.
In Kuwait.
Mm-hmm. In Kuwait, yes. Okay. And so I'm not wholly convinced by the claim that there was an assassination attempt on the former President Bush.
You mean if we just left him alone, you imagine that Saddam Hussein would, raise his kids and smoke a pipe?
I think what he's aiming for is regional dominance in the Middle East. And I think that is seen as a threat by many within the present U.S. administration and many people who are concerned with, say, the future of Israel. That's a different issue, though, from whether or not he would strike at Europe and America.
Well, are those not also, though, legitimate interests? This is the major oil source in the world. Israel is an ally of the United States.
Absolutely. I think they're legitimate interests, but they have to be addressed through different routes from the sort of discussion that's been had so far about Iraq's threat to the U.S. or U.K. in the form of terrorist attack.
Patrick Clawson, on the Baghdad terror link, persuasive to you or not?
Well, there certainly is a long history of Iraq being a state sponsor of terrorism, and it's not surprising that we find that the terrorist groups around the world have been cooperating with each other, even though they may hate much of what the other guy is doing. Their common hatred of the West is much greater than any of that.
But can you see Saddam Hussein putting chemical, biological weapons in some quantity into the hands of terrorists, giving them an unmanned vehicle, shipping it off of Manhattan for them, allowing Al-Qaeda to fly it into...
Well, certainly this episode that we saw recently in London, where there were some people arrested from the Al-Qaeda group who had chemical weapons, raises intriguing questions as to how they got those chemical weapons. And by the way, I never would have thought before September 11th of terrorists flying planes into buildings. And so terrorists can do some rather surprising things.
But you think Saddam Hussein would have an interest in assisting them in doing that, that he wouldn't be afraid of a backwash that might hit him as well?
Well, as Gwen was explaining, Saddam wants to dominate this rich region, and he thinks that the United States is the biggest problem for him doing that, and he thinks his best hope for being able to accomplish his goal is to scare us to leave that region, and if he can persuade us that he is very dangerous, then he thinks that might be able to be he might be able to get us out of the area.
Patrick Clawson, we only have 50 seconds left, but in summation, a credible case and a case sufficient for war soon. In your mind, yes or no?
Unfortunately, I don't think we can keep up long-term containment, and as a result, we have to decide whether we'll live with this risk or whether or not we're going to do something about it. And Powell explained why it's such a deep risk that I don't think we can live with it.
And Glenn Rangwala, your final thoughts here. Could inspections present a real alternative should we go to war?
Yes, very little in Powell's speech today that showed that inspectors wouldn't work in the long term or the short term in leading to Iraq's verifiable disarmament.
So you think that is a viable option?
I think it certainly is a viable option and the only practical option to take.
Well, there's the unpersuaded. We'll see what happens in the Security Council. Glenn Rangwala, thank you so much for staying up to such an ungodly hour in Cambridge, England.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Glenn Rangwala is lecturer in Middle East politics at Cambridge University. And Patrick Clawson in Washington, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Patrick Clawson is deputy director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. You can read highlights of Colin Powell's Security Council address on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Tamar Morad, Eileen Amada, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoke. With help from Darren Manoogian, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
is WBUR. We're funded.